Okay. So the project one is due today. And homework project two has been assigned. And then the homework two is due on Thursday. And then you'll get the spring break. And then you come back and do the exam. So I was just hearing the radio, and they said that it's too late to get out of the stock market now, because the right time to have gotten out was sometime last year, and now you're anyway sunk. And it's sort of like that for you too. It's too late to get out of the class now. You spent all this time on the project one. The right time to get out was beginning of the semester. So you spent all this time doing project one. Now you may as well do project two, and you know, get used to it. Okay. Let's see. So, are there any questions? Okay. So, what I am planning to do today to continue the discussion on real world and how to represent uncertain world, using probabilistic logics. Okay. So what we discussed last time was that the probabilistic propositional logic has problems in being able to represent real world, in the sense that there are just way too many preconditions and you will not be able to ever write them all down. There are too many effects, you will never be able to write them all down. And so there are like two interesting issues. You could be lazy or you could be ignorant, and it doesn't matter which is the right reality. So you may know everything about the world but want to do lazy reasoning, because taking everything into account makes your reasoning too costly. Or you may just be really ignorant. You don't really know how the world works. Okay? And either way, ultimately, you cannot depend on the propositional logic, and you need to be able to support plausible reasoning, default reasoning, where you come to conclusions that after additional knowledge would have to be retracted. Okay? And then we talked about multiple approaches for doing this, and then I talked about non-monotonic logics, uncertainty factors. Non-monotonic logics are still continuing. They are actually a reasonable way to deal with uncertainty, default reasoning in the world. And then there is certainty factors, which in essence, the problem with certainty factors is that they try to deal with uncertainty in what's called a truth functional manner. That means they try to assess the truth of a theorem based just on the few propositions that are taking part in the sentences, in that particular sentence. Okay? Unfortunately, what happens in probabilistic reasoning, in plausible reasoning, is that things that are not being listed, things that are not being listed in the theorem statement might well change the truth or falsity of the theorem. Okay? And so it's if things are truth functional, then it really is nice, because you can actually make the reasoning more efficient. Okay? But once you have uncertainty uncertainty, they're not truth functional, and so that's why you get into this kind of cycles. Cyclic reasoning, for example, you could say raining, implies grass is wet implies raining, and so you can get into a nice cycle. Okay. Ultimately then, what you need to deal with, as I said towards the end of last class, is probably go back to probabilistic reasoning and represent everything that you know about these propositions as just a bunch of random variables and a joint distribution on those random variables. Okay? This is probability 101 that you must have done already, and in today's class mostly we are actually going to just quickly review probability 101, except with a different view of it, where in the, you know, previously you were just being given these numbers and you're being asked to reason, you know, compute certain probabilities. Now we'll be wondering also as to where are these numbers coming from and can we get by with fewer numbers. Okay. So now in the probabilistic calculus, you know, suppose we know the likelihood of the each of the propositional words, you know, in the Perl, in the real Perl, in the Perl scenario. Remember that in the Perl scenario, well, I don't have this anymore. In the Perl scenario, you essentially have Perl living in Los Angeles and he has these two friends. So the things of interest in Perl scenario are earthquake occurring, burglary occurring, John calling, Mary calling. Right? Earthquake, burglary occurring, John calling, and Mary calling. Let me see if there's any more. John calling, Mary calling, and then alarm, of course. Okay? Those were the things that we are interested in. Okay, so in modeling, in Perl scenario. And so you could say, well, earthquake, burglary, alarm, John calling, Mary calling, all of these happen to be Boolean variables. So you can talk about every possible world. Okay, a possible world essentially is, you know, if these are Boolean variables and there are five of these, there are two power five worlds. Okay. And the interesting point is when you are talking about in probabilistic reasoning, for every possible world, you provide a number saying the likelihood that, in fact, you are in that world. Okay? In propositional reasoning, then in fact, of the 2 power 5 worlds, you're only in one of those worlds. So that is 1 and everything else is 0. Okay, in probabilistic reasoning, of these 2 power 5 worlds, you essentially give them numbers such that they all add up to 1. So if only one of them has non-zero value and everything else has zero values, and the one with the non-zero value has to be 1, and so it's actually propositional reasoning is a special case of probabilistic reasoning. Okay, so all we need is if we know the likelihood of each of the propositional worlds, okay, then just using the rules of probability, then basically once you have that, you have what's called a joint probability distribution. Okay, so in essence, it's telling you what's the probability that E is true, B is true, A is true, J is true, M is true. That's one number. Then E is true, B is true, A is false, J is true, M is false. That's another number. If I have these 32 numbers, then we will argue in a minute that, in fact, you know this in the back of your head, that if you know these 32 numbers, you can compute every possible query, the probability of every possible query. Right? Of course, I can always compute probabilities such as, what's the probability that the earthquake occurred and the burglary occurred and the alarm didn't go off, but John called and Mary didn't call? You know that number already because it's just a lookup of the 32 numbers. Okay? If on the other hand, you want to know what's the probability that Mary calls at all, that too is easy. Just add up the numbers for all the worlds where Mary is calling. This is what's called marginalization. You're marginalizing everything else. All we care about is Mary calling. So just add up the possible worlds where Mary calls, the probabilities of the possible worlds where Mary calls, and that will give you the Mary calling probability. Okay, similarly, if you want to know what's the probability that John and Mary calls, it's the same exact thing. Only count the number, probabilities of the worlds where John and Mary are calling. If you want John or Mary calls, again, it's the same thing. Okay, and then one more thing which we'll get to later on is what's the probability that John calls given Mary calls? You know this. These are conditional probabilities. Okay, but then you know how to compute these two because this is by definition probability of John and Mary calling by probability of Mary calling. And John and Mary can be computed with marginalization, and Mary also can be computed by marginalization. So in fact, if you have the joint probability distribution in front of you, all you need to know is marginalization. Marginalization essentially says, look at only the variables whose values you care about, and consider all the possible worlds where the variables have the values that you care about, and add those numbers up. Okay. Now the thing, of course, is that since these are the original 32 worlds, they are in essence, you know, they are expected in this representation to be mutually disjoint and exhaustive. Okay, they take the universe and split it into 32 different disjoint regions, and they cover the entire universe. So you can add up the numbers at this level. Okay, so if you have joint probability distribution, you can answer every query that you ever want to ask. Right? So that's a pretty useful thing. And then you also will not have any cycles, because, you know, basically you're just using a joint probability distribution and you would never get into cyclic reasoning. Okay, so all you need is joint probability distribution. That's all you need. Okay, now in the case of Perl example, so we basically need 32 numbers. In general, if you have n propositions, n Boolean variables, then you need 2 power n numbers. Actually, it's not really 2 power n numbers, it's 2 power n minus 1 numbers, if you want to be very strict. Because if you are given all the other numbers, then you add them up and subtract it from 1, it would be the last missing number, because they all are supposed to add up to 1. It's not 2 power n minus 1, it's 2 power n minus 1. So it's basically not much of a difference, it's totally 2 power n, you know, in most of the cases. Okay, so here is the interesting thing. So if I can give you 2 power n numbers, then you don't need to take this class anymore, because you know already how to deal with probabilistic reasoning. Right, you just, you know, basically use the elementary rules of probability to compute all the, you know, queries. Okay. So, if joint distribution is sufficient for reasoning, then why do I even need to tell you anything at all about what these variables are standing for? Do you understand what I'm saying? Instead of saying this is earthquake, this is Bulgari, this is alarm, this is John calling, this is Mary calling, I could have said here is V1, V2, V3, V4, V5, and nothing changes. It too requires only 32 numbers. So any world on 5 variables requires 32. Any scenario with 5 variables requires 32 numbers. That's all. Okay. So the first question you have to ask yourself is, from the point of view of probability theory, then what is the domain knowledge giving you at all? You know, if you know, for example, such you know, something saying that when earthquake occurs, alarm can go off. Does that change something in your number? Do you understand what I'm saying? So how do you, so the reality, of course, is that there are 32 ways, I mean, there are many, how many ways can you come up with 32 numbers such that they all add up to 1? How many different ways can you come up with numbers such that they'll all add up to 1? There should be, all these numbers should be between 0 and 1. And you just have to come up with 32 numbers such that they add up to 1. How many ways are there? Infinite number of them. Okay? There are infinite number of distributions here. Okay? The real question is, and in the worst case, to get to know what your specific distribution is, you need all 32 numbers. The big insight that I want you to take from, you know, discussion today, and, you know, and also much of this, you know, probabilistic reasoning discussion, is that domain knowledge allows you to get by with fewer numbers. Do you understand what I'm saying? So rather than require 2 power n numbers, 2 power n numbers to represent the joint probability distribution, if you happen to know the domain knowledge, what we are interested in doing is that the domain knowledge is typically, what does it do? It sort of locally constrains the values variables can take. For example, if earthquake occurs, then the probability that alarm goes off is higher. That's what basically you're saying. If earthquake occurs, alarm goes off. It's, if it is a propositional rule, that means whenever earthquake is true, alarm is true. If it is a probabilistic rule, then when the earthquake is true, alarm is true with a higher probability. Right? So of the infinite number of ways of splitting 32 numbers, you know, coming up with 32 numbers such that they'll add up to 1, having a single rule saying earthquakes tends to cause alarm to go off, we'll cut down these infinite number of probability distributions to a fewer number, smaller but still infinity possibly, but a fewer number. Do you understand what I'm saying? So your domain knowledge will reduce the number of joint distributions that are consistent with the world that you are actually living in. And in some sense, what, by the way, is the smallest number of numbers you would need? If you have five variables, what is the smallest number of numbers you would need to actually write down the entire joint distribution? What? One? Why?
Zero to the rest.
That's one way of looking at it. Another way is, suppose nothing is connected to anything. All these variables are sort of their own independent variables. Okay? Then what happens? So earthquake can be true or false independently of everybody else. Burglary can be true or false independently of everything else. Alarm can be true or false similarly. Okay? Now the truth and falsity probabilities are not necessarily equal. Maybe it's less likely to have earthquake than to have earthquake. But whether earthquake occurs or not doesn't depend on anything else. In some sense, I'm saying all these variables are independent. If they are maximally independent, that means nobody touches anybody else, then you need how many numbers?
Five
numbers. If you have n variables, you need n numbers. Instead of, then how does that, why did it not need the 32 numbers? Because those five numbers can be used to compute the 32 entries in the joint distribution. Okay, so for example, if I want E and not B and A and M and not J, and if these are all independent, then I just take the earthquake number, 1 minus the burglary number, alarm number, the Mary number, and 1 minus the John number, multiply them all out. I get one of the entries. Okay? And then, of course, once I have the joint distribution in front of me, I can solve everything. The difference is, previously you needed me to give you 32 numbers. Now, I just needed to tell you one assumption about the domain. Everything is independent. And then suddenly I don't need to give you 32 numbers. I just have to give you 5 numbers. Okay? In fact, I don't even need to give you any numbers if I say one more thing. Everything is independent and everything is equally likely. That means it's both plus and minus are equally likely. That means, so earthquake occurs half the time and other half of the time it doesn't occur. Okay? And so on. Okay? In which case I don't need to give you any numbers at all. Okay? So if there are no relations between the propositions, then the joint distribution can be specified in terms of the probability of each proposition being true, and only n numbers are needed instead of 2 power n. And in fact, in addition, if each proposition is equally likely to be true, then I don't even need to give you any numbers. And since I made a huge deal about getting numbers is the problem, then it looks as if these are the worlds you should live in. So my question is, would you like to live in such a world? Would you like to live in such a world? Would you like to live in a world where every possible property of the world is independent of every other possible property of the world? It makes computer programs extremely easy to write, right? But then it's going to be a really bad world for you because you have no control. You're not doing well in the course. Well, that's what it is. I can't do anything because there is nothing I can do that can influence my grade. Do you understand what I'm saying? So independence essentially means it's a pretty bad world for you. It's a very easy world to infer with, but it's also an easy world where nothing can actually, your chance of reaching any useful goal is close to zero. Okay? So be careful what you wish for. right? I mean, so let's look at this. So I said in the worst case you can do 2 power n num, you need 2 power n numbers. So the simplest scenario, you will only need n numbers, because every pair of variables is independent of each other. And the worst case scenario, where every subset of our variables is correlated together, everything is dependent on everything. Here you would need all 32 numbers or all 2 power n numbers. Would you like to live in such a world? I mean, obviously you didn't like to live in this world because it's too easy. Would you like to live in this world? Well, if you lived in this world, you won't be here. Okay? If everything is so interconnected, then we would never have actually had a chance to, you know, evolve as a species. Okay, because everything we can do can, you know, cause a nuclear explosion and the universe will disappear. Okay, so that level of interconnection, you hope, doesn't hold in the world. Neither do you want to hope that nothing is connected to anything. So what you expect really is a more realistic middle ground, where interactions between variables are sort of contained to regions. Okay, so there may be school variables, there may be home variables. School variables might sort of interact with each other. Home variables might sort of also interact with each other, but the school and home variables may only have loose connections. This is most of the worlds that you live in. The point I'm trying to make here is that in most reasonable probability distributions that you will have to model for the worlds that you are in, there are going to be certain independences that hold. And the domain knowledge is trying to, in essence, specify what independences hold. Okay? So here you don't need any domain knowledge, because everything is dependent on everything. I'm not telling you anything about the world. Here I gave you very strong domain knowledge. I said, you know, everything is independent of everything. And in between, maybe, well, you know, earthquake causes alarm. It doesn't directly cause Mary calling, but earthquake causes alarm. Alarm then causes Mary to call. That's a different kind of a mediated interaction that leads to certain types of independences between variables. Okay, so the whole game in probabilistic reasoning is to be able to write, have a language in which you can write these independence assertions and represent them compactly. And the reason you are interested in that is, if you know certain independences hold and if you can represent them, then you can exploit them very well in actually reasoning. Furthermore, if there are independences that hold, then the number of numbers that you would actually need to assess would be significantly less than 2 power n. Number of numbers you would need would be significantly less than 2 power n. Okay, so in particular, if, for example, I live in a world where there are n variables, but the maximally interacting set never is more than m, where m is much smaller than n. So at most, m variables will be interacting with each other. Okay, so home variables will be interacting with each other, school variables will be interacting with each other, but more or less they are independent of each other. In that case, then you will only need 2 power m numbers, of the order of 2 power m numbers, instead of the much larger 2 power n number. Okay, now, can people actually see who this person is? Why did I put him there? That's George Costanza. If you can explain to me why I put them there, you got, you know, some points which could affect your grade.
Because there's two Georges?
Yes.
Independent George.
And the relationship George. Okay, so you got points, my friend. Okay, so you have to watch Seinfeld and you also have to watch Simpsons to understand what's going on in the world. And there's a beautiful show where, you know, George basically finds that his home variables and his, you know, Seinfeld home variables are interacting. And, you know, he has all this great stuff about a George divided against himself cannot stand. But anyway, that's a great point, where he was keeping his home variables independent of his friendship George variables. Okay, and that's how he was living. And then when his girlfriend starts talking to Elaine, who is his friend, then suddenly these two worlds come colliding, and he has a much harder problem to solve now. Okay, anyway, so we do hope that most worlds that we live in, there are independences over sets of variables at least. Okay, so we will come to this in the end, you know, as we go on this direction. But basically what we are saying here is the local knowledge you have in the real world example is of this form. Burglary tends to cause alarm to go off. Earthquake tends to cause alarm to go off. Alarms tend to make John call. Alarm tend to make Mary call. These are not categorical statements. These are probabilistic statements. And here is a picture. Here is a burglary variable, earthquake variable, alarm variable, John calls, Mary calls. And I just wrote this set of propositional axioms, which are not fully propositional because they're not deterministic anymore, in this form here. Okay? So burglary causing alarm, earthquake causing alarm, alarm causing John calling, alarm causing Mary calling. This is, if you don't look at these numbers, this picture is the logical structure of the Perl world. Okay? And the moment you have this logical structure, then we will talk about how to exploit it. One of the interesting things is, if this logical structure holds, then you can get by giving only what are called conditional probability tables. So for every node in this network, by the way, this network is called a Bayes network. Okay, for every node in this network, you only need to give the conditional probability of that variable being true or false, given its immediate parents taking true-false values. So for this guy, burglary, there is no parent. So all I need to give is what's the probability of burglary being true, and then 1 minus that is the probability of burglary being false. Okay? And similarly for earthquake. And if I come to John calls, all I need to give is probability of John calling if alarm is true, and probability of John calling if alarm is false. And I don't need to give probability of John not calling when alarm is true, because it's just 1 minus 0.95. And similarly, John not calling when alarm is false is 1 minus 0.05. Okay? And then similarly, Mary calls. And then for alarm, since it has two, according to you, it has two immediate parents, you need to provide the probability that alarm is true, given burglary is true, earthquake is true. Burglary is true, earthquake is false. Burglary is false, earthquake is true. Burglary is false, earthquake is false. Okay. How many numbers did we give there? Basically, we gave 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. How many numbers did you have to give if you know nothing about this world? 32. Instead, you gave only 10. What is the smallest number of numbers you could have given to describe this world? None at all, if you just said everything is independent and positive and negative are equally likely. What is the smallest number of numbers you would have given if it was independent? 5. This is more likely world, and you have to give these many numbers. So the point here is, once you write the logical structure of your domain in a network fashion, then you know what are the probabilities to assess. And they would be conditional probabilities, and the number of numbers you need to assess would be much less than 2 power n. And that's a huge, big advantage in probabilistic reasoning. Okay. Now, of course, one of the interesting things is I need to explain to you why, given these numbers, I can get a joint distribution out of it. If you are ever in doubt as to whether or not this provides semantics for probabilistic reasoning, any representation provides semantics for probabilistic reasoning, all you need to do is, how does that representation give me an equivalent joint distribution? Once I have the joint distribution, I know how to do reasoning. So joint distribution is sort of like the truth table enumeration in logic for probability. Okay? So that's the scenario that basically what we'll be trying to do is get to understand writing these kinds of representations and reasoning with them. Okay? So we looked at this. And then here essentially is the higher level plan of the next several lectures, next at least two or three classes. Okay, so you may want to pay attention to this. First, you actually understand that you can always use joint distribution. Okay, and then that's what we'll spend some time today and just reminding you that if you know the joint distribution, you can get all the numbers you want. Okay, so it requires 2 power n for most. The time you take to use joint distribution to answer a query essentially is very similar to time you take to answer a query using truth tables in propositional logic. And remember, for the truth tables, I said this conventional oven potatoes versus microwave oven potatoes. So you'd spend a huge amount of time writing the entire truth table, and then every theorem, you'll just spend pretty much the same amount of extra time. Okay, so if you are using joint distribution, pretty much all queries will take about exponential amount of time to answer. Just all of them, equal amount of time. No more, no less. Okay, and it also needs 2 power n probabilities as input. And furthermore, the kinds of probabilities it requires is of the type: give me the probability that earthquake is true, burglary is true, alarm is false, John is true, Mary is false. See, it requires joint probabilities. Okay, since we said that we have to assess these numbers, we have to get these numbers from somewhere. Okay, the question is, what kind of numbers are likely to be easy to assess? That's an important question. Okay, and this guy requires these kinds of numbers. If you just use direct joint probability distribution, then it requires numbers for each of the possible worlds. Okay? And that is actually very hard to get. Those kinds of numbers are pretty hard to get. So if you have actually 10,000 variables, then you are looking for 10,000 variable conjunctive probabilities. To assess these probabilities, if you are a frequentist, then what you would say is, I will set up experiments to assess the probability. So you need to set up a 10,000 variable experiment, which is going to be pretty painful. Okay. Now, so I have two problems with this, and my problem is not this at all. The fact that in the worst case, you will wind up taking 2 power n amount of time to answer a query, that's no biggie for me. Because in the special case of probabilistic reasoning, which is propositional reasoning, what is the worst case? Time taken to prove a theorem. Exponential time. So you should actually be happy that it's no worse than exponential, even though you threw in probabilities. You understand what I'm saying? So you should start looking at, the bright side. It could have been undecidable, for all you know. So at least it didn't. It didn't become that much worse. It's still only exponential. Okay? You may have liked to see not everything being exactly exponential. Maybe some queries should be easy to answer, some may be in the worst case exponential. That we will look for. But we saw in propositional reasoning, we did have some queries that were easier to answer. And how did we do that? Using inference rules. So for example, any query that is answerable by modus ponens in one step is only O1 costly. All modus ponens queries are only polynomial time costly to prove. So if you can provide inference rules, then in essence, you can at least, for average case, some number of queries can be easier to answer, even though worst case queries will still be quite hard to answer, because you don't expect worst case to improve. Okay? So think of this. When you are understanding this, think of this as equivalent to the truth table enumeration-based theorems for the probabilistic logic. Okay? Then we will look at this, and so the next thing we'll look at is try to look for probabilities that are not necessarily a conjunction of all the world probabilities, but rather conditional probabilities. Okay, so instead of looking for probability of each world, I will look for probabilities of type x1, x2, x3 are true given y1, y2 are true. Okay, these are much more easier to assess because it's easier to set up experiments. It's easier to set up experiments for this. Okay, so for example, consider instead of Pearl scenario, consider you are a doctor and you're trying to get a probabilistic distribution for how people feel sick and how people fall sick, what sort of symptoms they have if they have different kinds of diseases. Okay, the probabilities you are assessing here are the probability that the patient is walking, has flu, doesn't have runny nose, doesn't have fever. Everything, every possible variable must have a value, and for that you need a probability. Here you get to assess probabilities of type, the probability that the patient has runny nose given that she has fever, or probability that the patient has fever, I mean probability that patient has flu given that she has runny nose. So you get to ignore all other variables and talk about just these small local conditional probabilities. These are easier to assess, but overall, if you don't have any extra domain knowledge, you will wind up needing exponential number of them too. Okay, but at least in some cases, at least it's no longer the case that everything takes 2 power n time. If you use these kinds of conditional probabilities and you use something called the Bayes rule, which we'll talk about. How many of you have heard of Bayes rule? Okay, if you use Bayes rule, then you get to use these conditional probabilities, and in particular, if I give you conditional probabilities in one direction, you can compute the conditional probabilities in the other direction using Bayes rule. Okay, and that is what you would do. That's what you understand as a second step. Up to here, you more or less know, you would know this directly, and you kind of know how to use Bayes rule from the probability, elementary probability class. Okay, and finally, we get to essentially talk about using Bayes rule with conditional independence assertions, which is more or less what you need to reason with these guys. And that's Bayes net. Okay? So that's the three things we'll do. We'll do this first, then this, and these two will take about 1.5 classes maybe maximum, and then we'll do Bayes net. And the reason we get here is by the time we get here, the reason you go from here to here is because you want probabilities that are more natural to assess. It's easier to set up experiments to assess these those kinds of probabilities. The reason you go from here to here is you want a representation where you can say what things are independent of what things in a, a flexible way, so that you can use that knowledge in improving the reasoning. Question? Yes?
How is the second approach easier to set up? I mean, if you have 10,000 variables, all we are doing is eliminating one by putting it as a given.
Yeah, no, I think all I'm saying is in the end, these will also be exponential number of numbers in the worst case. Okay? But it sort of cuts it in a different direction. We will look at, for example, how to use Bayes rule, for example, in this medicine scenario. Eventually you will start having to bite the bullet and say what is the probability that x1 is true, x2 is false, x3 is true, x4 is false, given y1 is true, y2 is false, y3 is true, y4 is false. At which point it starts looking pretty ugly anyway. But at least a conditional probability, you can set up experiments. So for example, it should be very easy, for example, to compute the probability that somebody, a random person having a runny nose, has flu. Right? You just stand near a doctor's office and keep looking at random people who have runny noses, then let them go into the doctor's office, and they come out with flu prescription or whatever, then you know that they have flu, and then you have computed the frequency number. You can also do the opposite, which is compute the probability that if you do have flu, you have runny nose. Okay? And so those are easier experiments to set up. Okay, so this is basically whatever I said here is written in words there. And come back to this game plan if you are getting, you know, stuck as to why are we doing what we are doing in probabilistic reasoning. And you have to understand this, because otherwise it makes no sense. You know, there is a reason why we do what we are doing. Okay? Other questions? Okay. So, I'm going to quickly review stuff that you should already know. In fact, we're going to review discrete variable probabilistic reasoning. So, discrete probability distributions instead of continuous ones. Okay, because that's what we'll do for a while. We will talk a little about continuous ones later, but mostly we'll look at discrete variables. Okay. So, it's sort of propositional probabilistic logic is similar to propositional logic, except the possible worlds are, and the possible worlds are still defined by the assignments of values to random variables instead of Boolean variables, which can, you know. So, the random variable can take either 0, 1 values, but with different likelihoods. Okay. So, for example, if I'm into dentistry, then I can talk about cavity, yes or no. That's a variable now. Okay. And similarly, I can also have propositional logic expressions, not burglary or earthquake. That could be a query. That's essentially saying burglary causes earthquake. And what's the probability that burglary causes earthquake? Okay. I will also, one thing that we will do without making a huge deal about it, is while propositional logic actually talks about Boolean variables, truth and falsity variables, you know, in CSP, we use multi-valued variables, right? In fact, propositional logic was just a subset of CSP, where in CSP you had variables which had multiple values, right? So we will consider in this case, in most of our work with probabilistic variables, we'll consider multiple valued discrete variables, okay? And then you talk about probability distribution. A distribution essentially giving you, for a particular variable, the probability that it takes different values. Okay? And a joint distribution tells you, for a set of variables, the probability that that set of variables takes a particular combined value. So if it's AB, then it tells you what's the probability that A is true, B is true, A is true, B is false, A is false, B is true, and so on. Okay, and then I have, so I can, for example, if I have weather can be sunny, rain, cloudy, and snow, and I want to talk about weather and cavity, you know, for whatever reason, I have decided to talk about joint distribution for weather and cavity, okay, I will wind up having to talk about these numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, okay. And then one other thing you should remember is the conditional probability definition. This is again from elementary probability reasoning. A conditional probability is just defined as, so, you know, P A given B is probability of A and B divided by probability of B. Okay? In particular, in essence, what we are really talking about is the fraction of worlds where B is already true, where A is also true. So given all the worlds where B is true, which fraction of those worlds does A also hold true? That's what is the conditional probability. Okay? And then if you divide both numerator and denominator, you can convert it into probabilities. Okay? And then this definition in itself gives you, so basically I just wrote that P A given B is P A and B by P B, right? I can take this side. So P A and B can be written as P A given B times P B or P B given A times P A. How does the second one come? Because I could have written this instead of P A given B, I could have written as P B given A. It should also have been P A and B by P A. And the guy who is common for both of them is A and B. So A and B can be written in two different ways, A given B times PB, PB given A times PA. Now what's interesting about this is if you have this, then I get to write PB given A is PA given B times PB by PA. What is that called? Bayes rule. Okay, this is called Bayes rule, and Bayes became extremely famous apparently for doing this bit of elementary algebra. Okay, why is this interesting? Why this is interesting, and we'll get to it in a minute after the joint distribution part is over. Remember that we talked about people, so I could P flu given runny nose can now be computed in terms of P runny nose given flu times P flu by P runny nose. Okay. Now, you may not be medical doctors, but you know what causes what. Do runny noses cause flu or flu cause runny nose? What? Flu causes runny nose. Runny noses don't cause flu. What do you pay doctors money for? Do you ever go to a doctor and ask, doctor, doctor, I'm suffering from flu, can you check if I have a runny nose? You ask that. If you want to provide that kind of a service, there are very few patients that come, right? Normally, you want to answer this question. The doctor needs to answer this question for you. You have a runny nose, we know that, you know, but we want to know whether or not you have flu. And doctors' textbooks are going to have these numbers. If they have any textbooks at all, they are going to have numbers in the causal direction. The probability that flu would cause runny nose would be given to them. And they are able to use that number to compute the number for which they get money. This is why Bayes rule is important, because it's able to convert causal probabilities into diagnostic probabilities. The word diagnosis is used with respect to doctors, right? And basically because the whole point of medicine is going from symptoms to causes. People come with symptoms, and you need to figure out whether they have, what is the cause, what's the disease that's causing the symptom. Okay, so that's what Bayes rules would be used for, but that sort of comes directly from the definition of conditional probability. Okay. So one interesting thing is that when you're talking about conditional probabilities also give us another thing to talk about, which is, let's go back here. If I know propositionally, I mean logically, I know that B implies A. It's true. This is known. This is a deterministic rule. B implies A. Okay? What is the probability that A given B? What's the probability of A given B? Everybody understand that? Okay. What about probability of B given not A? Probability of B given not A. What? Zero. Why? Because if not A is true and B implies A, then not B is true. And if you forgot this, you can also do it by resolution. B implies A is not B or A, not A, not B. That's modus tollens. Okay? And then, what about probability of B given A? You can't find it, but is it zero? If it is zero, you would never have written this. Do you understand what I'm saying? If, in fact, B never causes A, That's the only time P be given A would be 0 is that B can never possibly the cause for A. Okay, we don't know the exact value, but we know that it's not 0. Those three formulas, in essence, connect two words that you know. One is a little implication from propositional logic, and what that becomes in terms of conditional probability. Right? Okay. So, in some sense, this one implication affects these three conditional probabilities. Okay. So, think of, when you think of conditional probabilities, tend to think of implications, although they're not exactly one and the same. That's basically, you're saying they're connected. Okay. Now, here's another interesting thing. Suppose I said probability of A given B is probability of A. What would I have meant? Yeah, so that means if this is true, could it then be the case that I know if in my world B implies A is true, can these two both be true in my world? Do you understand what I'm saying? So again, I'm combining my logical intuitions with my probability numbers. Okay, if in fact A given B is equal to A, then basically B has no effect on A. Okay, what if probability of A given B is greater than probability of A or less than probability of A? That means you had some idea about whether or not A would be true in a random world, but the moment I tell you B is true, your likelihood for A being true has either increased or reduced. What does that remind you? So I said Tweety is a bird. And you thought, yeah, there's some sort of a probability that Tweety will be flying. And then I said, Tweety is a cartoon bird. Then you said, oh, no, I mean, Tweety is an ostrich. I'll make Tweety an ostrich now, suddenly. Okay? Tweety is an ostrich. Then you say, no, it's not going to fly. And then I say, Tweety is a magical ostrich. Then you say, wow, it's going to fly. Then magical ostrich, which just had a big band-aid, you know, had an injury and a big band-aid on its wings. So it's not going to fly. So I am asking the same query, probability Tweety flies up front, and then probability Tweety flies given Tweety is ostrich, probability Tweety flies given Tweety is ostrich and Tweety is magical, and so on. Whatever that story I was telling you about Tweety are really a series of conditional probability values. As evidence mounts, conditional probabilities can change. Okay? The thing that you are interested in much of probabilistic reasoning is computing posterior distributions. Posterior distributions, that means you know upfront, before you I even said anything about Tweety, just because I said Tweety is a bird, there's a prior on Tweety flying. And then I said Tweety is an ostrich, then you are interested in Tweety flying given that Tweety is ostrich. That may be bigger, smaller. Okay? In particular, what happens, and this is a picture to keep in mind, we are not just interested in whether Tweety flies or not, but in general we are really interested in the distribution for Tweety flying. Since it's a Boolean variable, it only has two values. It is true and false. If it's a multi-valued variable, it will have multiple possible values. You know, for example, the weather. The weather can be rainy, sunny, freezing, and dry, or whatever, let's say. So there are four possible values. And upfront, if I tell you I'm somewhere, and you think the probability that it's raining, or sunny, or everything is equally likely. So you assume uniform distribution. Then I say I'm in Phoenix, then you change your probability. Then I say Phoenix is having unusually cold weather this year. Then you change your possible probability again. Okay? So what happens really is, let's say a probability of A, which is without knowing any evidence, any additional evidence, that would be the prior probability distribution. Okay? And these are the possible values A can take, and you know, these are discrete possible discrete values A can take, and the total distribution. And if I give you probability of A, given B is true, if I tell you the evidence that B is true, then I get a new distribution for A. And it could look like this. Okay, so previously, every possible value is equally likely, but now this value is much more likely than any other value. And this are the most likely values, sort of. Okay, and then I give you some more evidence, probability A and B equal to true and C equal to false, then I might get a different distribution. By this time, actually, it becomes sort of, most of the probability is concentrated here. So as the evidence increases, the distribution, hopefully, you know, if you get the right kind of evidence, the distribution hopefully becomes peaked. So, you know, if you are a detective, probability that one of you guys killed the victim, okay? So killed by X, Y, Z, etc., and they're all uniform in the beginning because I had no clue who did it. But as I keep getting more and more evidence, you know, hopefully it will start peaking in certain areas. And you now know that those are the suspects. Okay? And if you are a doctor, then when they came in, the probability that they are suffering from a disease, I mean, any of these diseases, you know, D1 to D1000 is almost equally likely. But some diseases are even a priori very less likely. You know, for example, Ebola is very low likelihood in Phoenix. Valley fever is there, but still quite low likely. Okay, so in the beginning, it's not necessarily uniform. It is some sort of a, you know, non-uniform distribution. But after the doctor asks some more questions and does some more tests, you will wind up getting a distribution that's peaked in the middle, somewhere, you know, hopefully closer to the few diseases that you'll actually be suffering from. Okay, so conditional probabilities are useful in understanding the notion of posterior distribution because that's really what you're trying to compute by getting evidence. Okay. One thing I want to do now is, since I told you that you can answer every query using joint distribution, okay, I gave some numbers. Let's see whether we can compute these probabilities. So I have two Boolean variables, toothache and cavity. Okay, and so since there are only four different words, and you have to add them all up, and they have to become one. So those are the variables. Okay. So can you actually compute every one of these values? Yes. Okay, what is probability of cavity and toothache? What? That one, right? 0.04. So this is actually a lookup query. What about just cavity? That would basically be 0.04 plus 0.06. That would be 0.1. Right? What about toothache? It's the same thing. So you add up these two values, 0.04 plus 0.01, so it's 0.05. What about cavity or toothache? So you essentially have to consider all the words where cavity is true. Where cavity is true, there's a 0.04 word. Cavity is also true in a 0.06 word. Toothache is true in a 0.04 word, and toothache is also true in a 0.01 word, but you double counted one word, right? Because one word where both of them are true got counted twice, so you should remove that, right? So that's exactly what you do. In fact, you know this rule for probability of ARB. Is probability of A plus probability of B minus probability of A and B. That's what you wrote, right? And that makes direct sense from just the possible words. Okay? So in this particular case, probability of A is just adding up all the words where toothache is true. Probability of B is adding up all the words where cavity is true. And then probability of A and B is the one world where both of them are true. You have to subtract it because you counted it twice. Okay? So you can answer that too. Can you answer this? Probability of cavity given not toothache. Actually, in fact, let's answer probability of cavity given 2 theory. Oh, no, actually, let's answer this. Cavity given, not 2 theory. How do you do this? Wake up. I let you guys sleep today because you did the project one, but no, you owe me something. But hopefully, you know, next class you'll wake up. But right now you have to wake up and tell me what happens here. So how do you do probability of cavity and not toothache? Probability of cavity and not toothache divided by probability not toothache. Right? That's just the definition of conditional probabilities. So cavity and not toothache, what is that? 0.06. And probability of not toothache. What's the probability of not toothache? 0.06 plus 0.89. Okay? So 0.06 by 0.95. Right? 0.95. So what's that going to be? Is that going to be bigger or smaller than 0.06? Is it going to be bigger or smaller than 0.06? Right. Okay. So if you don't have a toothache, apparently the probability of you having cavity in this particular case increased. Is this a reasonable numbers I gave here to you? No. But I get to make any possible, you know, this is a la la world where people not having toothaches are likely to have cavities. You understand what I'm saying? Because I'm just telling you what the numbers told me, right? I mean, in this particular case, if I come up with these numbers, then when I don't have toothache, then this is 0.06, and you know, probability of not having toothache is 0.06 plus 0.89, and so 0.06 by 0.95, that will increase the probability of cavity now. Because prior probability of cavity is only 0.06. Oh, wait. No, I'm sorry. No, I'm sorry. So this is greater than 0.06, that's okay. But the real question is, what's the probability of cavity? What's the prior probability of cavity? Prior probability of cavity is 0.01. Okay, so this is what you need to compare to this. What? Point one. Okay, this is what you need to compare to this. So 0.1 should be compared to 0.06 by 0.95. Which will be more than 0.06, but it's likely to be less than 0.1. You can, you know, do your calculator and you'll get the exact number. But thankfully, in fact, this is fine because this shows that cavity was originally, if you know, the patient walked in, the probability that the patient has cavity is 0.1. But then you did some tests and found that they have toothache. I've just asked them to talk and they say, oh, I have toothache. And then now you think that the cavity, I'm sorry, they don't have toothache, you know, then the probability that they have cavity has now reduced. Okay? So that's basically what, and so those are all the numbers. So in fact it's 0.0631 as compared to 0.1. 0.1 is smaller than, I mean, is larger than 0.0631. Okay, so probability of cavity has reduced after you found that this person has no toothache. So this is actually a reasonable number. Okay? And in computing probabilities this way, really you should just think of this as using truth tables. In essence, for every possible query, you are computing all possible worlds that are consistent with that query. And adding them are numbers, adding their numbers, that's all. Mostly that's what you're doing. And if it's a complex query like A or B, then you have to avoid double counting. Okay? I would go ahead and argue the following, that ultimately, every query that you really want to compute, ultimately would be computing something of the type A is true and B is false and C is true. That's it. So that's basically a conjunctive. If you know how to compute the probability of a conjunction, then you know everything else. Why? Because everything else, such as A or B, can be written ultimately as probability of A plus probability of B minus probability of A and B, this is a conjunction of 1, this is a conjunction of 1, this is a conjunction of 2. And if you have conditional probabilities A given B, that A is probability of A and B by probability of B, that's a conjunctive probability, that's a conjunctive probability. So really all you need is to know how to compute conjunctive probabilities, and then you just do maybe once in a while subtractions, once in a while divisions on the numbers you compute. So the question is, how do you compute a general conjunctive probability given joint distribution? So if I have a formula phi, which is basically a conjunction of variables and their values, but not necessarily all of them. It can be just one variable and its value, or you know, some subset of variables and their values. How do you compute P phi? How do you compute this? All you do is you marginalize over the variables that are not appearing in the query, or look for all the worlds where this, you know, P phi is A equal to true and B is false and C is true. Then look at all worlds where A is true, B is false, C is true. Ignore all other variables essentially, and then add up those values. Okay, and you know that a joint distribution basically gives, for every variable VI, the possibility, you know, it basically gives the values for every complete assignment. Joint distribution gives values for every complete assignment. And a conjunction may be looking at a partial assignment, and that really corresponds to potentially exponential number of complete assignments, where you consider all other guys to be either true or false, and you add them up. Okay? So that's basically what is said here. So using a full joint distribution ultimately involves, you know, given a proposition of phi or a formula phi defined over the random variables, you know, given a world, either the phi is true in that world or not true, and that you can check right away. And what you're trying to do is essentially add up the probabilities of all the worlds where phi is true. That's it. Okay? And another way of looking at it is, in fact, a general probability query will actually be of the following type. A general probability query is always of the type, what's the probability of distribution of X given Y? So give me the probability that certain variables take certain values, given that I know certain other variables have already taken certain values. Okay? Now this is general in the sense that if Y is empty set, then I just ask for PX. Right? Now this can be computed, since I said everything can be computed in terms of conjunctions, this can really be computed in terms of probability X and Y by probability Y. Right? This is a conjunction. And one other trick is the following thing. If I basically compute probability of X equal to true given Y, okay, and probability of X equal to false given Y, those numbers should add up to 1. Right? Okay, this is not true though. Probability of X is true given Y is true plus probability of X is true given Y is false, that's not 1. That's not 1. Okay, but this definitely is 1. And since this is 1, in essence actually I could say that whenever I'm computing probabilities of this type, really I would just essentially, I won't even compute this probability of Y anymore separately. Instead, I compute the distribution for the numerator. And then if you add both, all the values, they have to be equal to 1. Okay? And that's pretty much what is being said here. And that's the last thing we'll do, and then you get to go home. So if I am asking the values for, you know, what's the probability of query variables Y taking different values, given that the evidence variables E take certain specific values. So So what's the probability that A and B will take, you know, what are the probability joint distribution of A and B given C is true and D is false? Okay, and then suppose in my world the total number of variables are A, B, C, D, E, F. Then H is the total number of variables minus the query variables minus the evidence variables. So in the A, B, C, D, E, F, I am asking query in terms of A and B. I gave you evidence in terms of B and C, so A and B and C and D. So the things that are left are E and F. So the E and F, I essentially need to marginalize them. They can take either true value or false value. Okay? And so this distribution, when I'm computing the probability distribution for Y, given the evidence variables take a certain value that has been given as the evidence, is nothing but essentially alpha times, which is a normalization constant, times probability that Y takes certain values. So if you are looking at the distribution and you are trying looking at, let's say, if the Y is in terms of A and B, then if probability of A and B given C equal to true, D equal to false, then you are interested in computing probability of A true, B true, C always true, D always false, because that's what the evidence said. And then E and F can be either true or false. E is true or false, F is true or false. Okay, if you, in this particular case, you will get 2 times 2, 4 values, which are going to all have, all those worlds will have those variables having those values. You add them up, then you will get the entry corresponding to probability of A being true and B being true. And then similarly, you can get the entry for probability of A being true, B being false. A being false, B being true, A being false, B being false. Now, all of them would be of the type alpha times, one of them will be saying alpha times 0.9, alpha times 0.3, alpha times 0.4, alpha times 0.5, and all I know is they should all add up to 1. So if I add them all up to 1, and so if I say alpha times this plus this plus this plus this equal to 1, and I solve that equation, I get the alpha. Okay? So that's it. That's all you need to do. If you have a joint distribution in a huge big table in front of you, you can write a little computer program which can take any arbitrary probabilistic query and answer it. And what it's doing essentially is marginalization over the variables. And one other thing it did is this normalization. It basically, for the price of, if you are computing the distribution anyway, and the values for all the distribution cells should add up to 1. So then you'll never have to do the probability of evidence variables separately. Okay? We'll stop here, and next class we'll get into Bayes' rule and Bayes' network.